From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 18th installment of a conversation that we've been having with Professor Luciana Bone about the political economy, the history, in essence, of the founding and the untimely demise of the USSR, the period from, say, 1917 until 1991. Luciana, it's a pleasure to have you with us again.
Thank you, Don.
So we left off in Spain, really in Catalonia, which is an interesting place to leave off these days. and we were talking about essentially how the war was lost when you had essentially the government in power being attacked by fascists who at the beginning were kind of feuding with each other. You had the left and the anarchists and popular forces generally siding with the government. And then we got to the point where there were groups that decided to go it alone. They decided, instead of working in coalition with the rest of the society, that now was the time for revolution while they were under attack. And we were starting to get to how that played out. So let's go there.
That's right. Last time we talked about the economic effects of the social revolution that the anarchists and I shall call them Trotskyists, the PUM, engineered in parts they were in control of, and namely Catalonia, Aragon, and places like that. And we demonstrated, we talked about, well, last time, about how this taking over of the means of production created economic chaos. Right. And nobody knew who should decide, and we went into that last time. But today, I want to talk about how the Republic of Spain, the loyalist side, the Republican side, formed its own army, because we have to remember that when Franco arrived in Spain, he had with him inside Spain the whole military echelons, the higher upper echelons, the whole military command, you know, whatever we would call the Pentagon. So he came with forces from Spanish Morocco, and the army of what had been the army of the Republic sided with Franco, which meant that the Republic had a very minimal army.
Well.
Right?
That's right.
It had some officers and some, but, you know, and this is what I want to talk about, how this army was formed mainly through the efforts of the Spanish Communist Party in tandem and together with Moscow and really quite obstructed in its formation in the beginning by the forces of the anarchists and what I call the Trotskyists, the PUM, okay?
Yeah, that's a good outline of it too. Good. So let's do that.
Okay. So after Franco's led military rebellion, the Republic was left with a decimated officer corps and a severely weakened army in the regions which were in the Republic's control. So the army, this army, was the one that had been unable to resist the rebellion. So the fighting mainly fell to the militia units organized by the various labor unions. So the CNT had its own militia, the PUM had its own militia, the UGT had its own militias. And I think, if I may interject here, this is the idea of a people's army that comes up. It was also the sort of formation that worked in the Russian Revolution initially. But anyway, so the militias were inexperienced. They lacked discipline and coordination. Unlike in Soviet Union in World War II, they didn't have a stavka. They didn't have a general staff directing the war,
right.
Imagine. So... And there were, so these militias even had a rivalry between them.
Yeah.
And this, you know, who would get what arms? There was no central command distributing arms, organizing transportation. Right. Think about it. So because they lack a centralized command and general staff, and this is, those people who say that, you know, Stalin wasn't significant in World War II, it was the people who fought.
Yeah, right.
Well, no, they had a central command, a stavka.
Yeah.
It was made up of generals.
I posted today at my Facebook page, had stumbled on YouTube, a radio address that Stalin gave on, I think it was July 3rd. Of 1941. Now, Hitler attacked, I think it was June 22nd of 1941. So this is, you know, 10, 11 days later. He spoke for about 28 minutes and essentially outlined the strategy that was going to be followed, which ended up being the strategy that was followed, which ended up being the strategy that won the war. You know, we're talking about this scorched earth policy as it came to be known. He didn't use that terminology then. And a people's war, in essence. And, you know, you've got all these other folks that have, you know, from mommies.
Yeah.
But you've got people who since then have been looking at, you know, what happened in Soviet Union and contrasting what they say happened with what should have happened, people's wars and people's revolutions. But in fact, that was a people's war, and it was won because it was a people's war, and Stalin designed it over the radio. That's okay. No. And I'm saying, and Stalin basically called for it over the radio at the very beginning.
That's right. And I forget what the percentage of communist members were in the army, but they weren't overwhelming.
Right.
I mean, they were large.
Larger than the society at large, but not, right. It wasn't even a majority, I don't think.
No, that's right. And that alone makes it a people's
that's
army.
That's right, absolutely.
Yeah, but a people's army has to have an organization that directs it too.
Well, yeah, if you want to win. Yeah, if you want to win. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
So this is another contrast, you know, not having an organized, what is the Stavka called?
Yeah, like an officer's corps or whatever, you know, a hierarchy,
it's
essentially.
It's a central planning committee.
Yeah, right. Okay, right.
Of the war.
Okay, right.
I mean, the Pentagon, I think. But, yeah. Okay. Well, I don't know, not even the Pentagon. But anyway, what was the Stavka? It was a...
You're talking about the general staff, basically. The you
general
know,
the, staff.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. Okay. Excellent.
Right.
And this militia lacked weapons. And because, of course, the army had taken what they needed, Franco's armies. They lacked heavy weapons. So... And in addition, they lacked heavy weapons, which one, so there were three players in the Spanish, foreign players in the Spanish Civil War, Germany,
right.
Italy,
right.
And the Soviet Union.
That's right.
The Franco got 2/3 of the total army foreign weapons from Italy and Germany,
right.
and a third was supplied to the Republic by the Soviet Union. 600 planes, I don't know, 700 pilots,
right.
Advisor, a considerable contribution by the Soviet Union to the Republicans. So 1/3, you know, 2/3 of the foreign weapons went to Franco. 1/3 went to the Republic by the Soviet Union. Britain and France contributed nothing.
Mexico, however, did. Mexico threw a couple of million dollars and 20,000 rifles and some other things, and political support. They took a strong political stance, backing the government.
That's right. They had their own revolution.
Yeah, that's right.
So in the initial months of the Civil War in 1936, after July, the Ministry of War had little authority over transport, because as we noted, the transport was in the hands of the CNT, of the Anarchist Union, trade union, and was forced to rely on the National Committee of Road Transport, that is, the Ministry of War, which, as I said, was controlled by the CNT and the UGT. The Anarchist Union is the CNT, and the UGT is the Socialist Party Union.
Right.
So anyway, the committees, the unions, and the parties disregarded demands from the Ministry of War and retained equipment and vehicles for themselves and their own militia forces, which sometimes, eventually they turned on each other.
Right.
One second, I have my outline here. And a recalcitrant computer.
Yeah, we all have those. While you're doing that, I'm looking, meanwhile, you've got some minor players on the international stage. Portugal, for example, was involved the Irish government prohibited participation. The IRA sent the Irish Brigade to fight alongside Franco. And that was based on Catholicism, apparently, to fight communism.
Go ahead.
Yes, they were fighting communism in defense of the Catholic Church.
Ooh.
This was even O'Duffy, the Irish Brigade.
But now we're in 1936, so which Ireland was it? The North?
No. It was Ireland.
This is the Republic of Ireland.
This is the IRA. This is the IRA. Yeah.
Very strange.
Yeah.
Very strange how these so-called lefties manage.
Well, you have, what you had going on, two things that I think were probably attractive. One, that attracted those elements. Number one, the nationalist struggle in the UK of Ireland against the Brits. Religion is the sort of the soil that takes place in, or in any event, that's the dressing that they put on it, and Catholicism. And so they had that in common, because they were painting the Republicans, whether they were just liberals or even not so liberal supporters of the government, all the way out to the communists, as secularists and atheists and hostile to the Catholic Church. So the Catholic, they were rallying fellow Catholics, and also you had nested within that the nationalist struggles in both the Basque and Catalonia, which of course the Irish could identify with at that time as well. So it's complex,
Sure, but I have to add something else.
Sure.
In 1921, I think that's the date, you had a civil war in Ireland and the socialist side won. So what you have in power in Ireland is a compromised IRA.
That's right. Yeah.
I mean, so because the usual excuse is whoever fights Britain, we're on their side.
Right.
Whether it's Hitler or in India, whatever, on their side. But
that's
this is not the case, except that Britain was fighting against the Republic passively by not helping and et cetera.
Right.
So I would think that because the, let's say, the socialist branch of the Irish Republic in 1921 lost the Civil War, this is the consequence of that defeat, is that the existing Irish government in Dublin sided with the fascists on grounds of Catholic, possibly Catholic sympathy.
Yeah, you know, by the way, O'Duffy was also the head of the what they called the NCP, which was a fascist party, National Corporate Party. And he was the one that was recruiting. And they had sent about 7,000 people in the Irish Brigade, but it became a real problem at home, as it turns out. Sorry, yeah. we're off the track. Let's get back. Go ahead. So
because of, and this is early in 1936, because of the need in 1936, because there was this need to create a centralized military, a centralized run military, the Communist Party of Spain was in favor of establishing a regular army and integrating the militias into this new force. So they, the Communist Party, were the first to dissolve their militia forces, including the 5th Regiment, which is one of the most effective units in the war, and create a mixed brigade, a People's Army, forming the core of the new Popular Army. These units, however, were firmly under the oversight of the Communist Party. One second. Mm-hmm. I don't know why I'm having this trouble today.
That's okay. These things happen. I'll update, by the way. I just found, as a matter of fact, there was also, although it was smaller, an Irish brigade, the International Brigade, sent organized by the Communist Party of Ireland, that supported strongly the Republican side in the Civil War, and like a quarter of them died, you know, fighting that war. They were, you know, they were heroic. So
amazing.
You know, they put in their, you know, they were well represented on our side as well.
And so, yeah, the Popular Army. So these units were firmly under the oversight of Communist Party commissars, and that would be from Moscow, and under the command of experienced army officers. So, I mean, the Communist Party eventually came to dominate the leadership of the new army through their commissars, Soviet advisors, and NKVD agents, also exercised considerable influence within the new armed forces. All of this presence of communists in the struggle seems to have really upset the anarchists and the communists.
Right.
The CNT, the Anarchist Trade Union, and the PUM, the Marxist,
the Trotsky
side, and other socialist militias initially resisted the integration. Resisted the integration. The CNT, the Anarchist Trade Union, saw the militias as representing the will of the people, while a centralized army was against their anti-authoritarian principles.
I mean, you talk about being chained down by ideology.
Yes.
You know, it's so clear.
Abstraction.
Yeah, exactly.
They're amazing, yes. They also fear the army as an organ of the Communist Party. So we see that in Spain, communism represented a threat for a sizable fighting force on the side of the Republicans.
That's right.
Communism was seen, if you stretch it, communism was as bad as fascism. Isn't that the ideology of some weird lefties today?
Well, that's certainly of anarchists. You know, the Soviet Union was, in essence, the same as Nazi Germany. It's just different forms. You know, that, well,
Amazing, the
stock certificates are in the name of the government or the people in this case, instead of in the name of the actual owners. But it operates the same way. That's their argument, in, you know, distilled down from absurdity to something intelligible.
Yeah. So the CNT, the Anarchist Union, were eventually forced to yield to militarization, since the government refused to supply arms to the militias unless they joined the regular army.
Right.
But so We have events in Catalonia of May, which 3-day kind of uprising against essentially the communist direction of the war. And this is what George Orwell celebrates in Homage to Catalonia. And out of the Spanish Civil War comes a mythology that the Stalinist, you know, this word Stalinist Soviet Union had crushed the social revolution, which we have seen last time, seized all the businesses and brought the production, the economic production, to a standstill. So had crushed this amazing social revolution, which would have, in the mythology, you know, seized the land from the landlords and seized the factories and then didn't know how to rule it, had this wonderful militia, spontaneous people's army.
It would have rolled right over the borders and swept across Europe and then the whole world with the revolution. That's the mythology.
Amazing. Yeah. While Germany was providing 600 planes, Italy 700, and to Franco, and, you know, I don't know what to say.
And the USSR providing 600-800 planes also to the other side. In other words, Orwell offered some typewritten words or handwritten words, and while the Trotskyists were offering poems and, you know, tribute to the heroic people, the Soviet Union was building and shipping and building an infrastructure for transshipping armaments to the people to protect themselves from the fascists.
That's right. They were trying to save a simple the state.
That's right.
Like Russia did with Syria.
With Syria, that's exactly right. You're looking at the way imperialism is, you know, treating, you know, the world events now, nation states now. They essentially turn them into failed states. And so, you know, when you step in and prop up states just so that they can remain intact, provide basic services, not create another, you know, area that's on fire socially, politically, militarily, and everything else, that necessary step is looked at somehow as counter-revolutionary.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, exactly right. This is it. If, you know, the Soviet Union hadn't intervened, it would have been immediately taken over by
fascism. Like Czechoslovakia.
So these two myths came out of the Spanish. I was saying that two myths developed. One that Stalinist Soviet Union had crushed the people's social revolution of the anarchists and the Trotskyists, and that they did so to somehow please Britain and France.
Yeah, that was a brilliant strategy.
That is, that Stalin didn't back the social revolution because this would have upset Britain and France, and he was such a fool not to understand, according to this logic, that France and Britain would egg on Hitler to attack the Soviet Union. Ha, 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 ha.
Right.
Isn't he stupid?
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's the same kind of... They impute, like, you know, the personal characteristics of you know, individual behavior to to nation states. You know, Hitler might have thought that he was Germany, and the people on the ground, some of them, might have thought that he was Germany. But in general, the industrialists, the capitalists, the military leaders, they all knew, you know, what time it was. And so you don't goad Hitler or you don't goad Germany into war. They do a calculation. And because the mythology is he was crazy, started a two-front war, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm sure that there's some aspect of that that's true. But in reality, the number of resources that you have to mobilize and the cooperation that's required from thousands of senior administrators, generals and officers in the military and the the pinnacles of production and the rest of the society, it doesn't work that way. And so Stalin knowing this, since he's sitting in the midst of a group of people that are building an economy from whole cloth to protect itself from what's coming from Hitler, understands this, and yet they, you know, they have this kind of popular myth that, well, Stalin didn't want to get Britain and France mad at him, and so they went in and they betrayed the revolution, and he just got betrayed, and that's what happened. That's basically, it's like you're hearing a 5-year old narrative, you know, a 5-year old child's narrative.
Yeah. So there's the first myth was this that we talked about just now, and the second charge against Stalin, and I noticed that Chomsky supports this one. This one is really quite insane, I think, in a metaphorical sense.
Understood. Yes, I gotcha.
And the second myth is that Stalin, failed to support the nationalist mobilization, nationalist anti-imperialist mobilization in Spanish Morocco, which was brewing, I don't know how to the boil it was, but which was brewing, so that if Stalin had at the same time supported a anti-colonial struggle mobilization in Spanish Morocco, this would have weakened Franco's army, and therefore Stalin lost the Spanish Civil War by not doing that.
Which is
now,
insane.
Are we understanding that there are two things here, two myths, two things that could not happen
at the same
anyway?
Time? Yeah. Certainly not at the same
the
time.
The Soviet Union wasn't defending, wasn't doing a Bolshevik revolution in Spain. That's up to the Spaniards.
That's right.
It was defending, that's what we said, that's up to the Syrians.
That's right.
You know? What he was defending is what you said, the integrity of a state.
That's right.
That is, stay together and then do the Bolshevik revolution when you are together, if you like.
If you like, right.
And the second thing is, they expected these left, and even today, expected Stalin and, you know, to mount an anti-colonial revolution and support it in Morocco, while Stalin knew Hitler was at the gates, almost.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, the theory, again, is in this magical thinking universe that some of these folks reside in, that if you light matches everywhere, you can set everything ablaze, and at the end of the day, there will be a communist paradise that will spring up magically in its place. That all you need do is burn down the forest, and you know,
yes.
And utopia, it lies under the ashes or inside the, I don't know, somewhere.
Yeah.
Maybe it's in one of the trees and it falls out. I don't know. But
I don't know.
You know, the reality
the
of
phoenix.
It is that
it's the myth of the phoenix.
This is, we're talking in 1936, 1937, 1938. We're talking 20 years or less since the country withdrew from World War I, devastated, a revolution, a brand new economy that started on the ashes of a feudal economy, in essence, with some economic development in the cities, you know, some industrial development in the cities. They are about to be attacked by basically the rest of Europe, except for the UK. By the time they come, they've conquered or allied with the rest of Europe. And while we're constructing our defenses here, and trying to preserve this nation state at the rear end of this thing, let's go fight over in Africa, by the way, and see if we can't spark an anti-colonial revolution there. Yeah. We're going to have to pick that up there next week because we're out of time.
Let me just interrupt a second if you have a minute.
No, we don't. We have 30 seconds.
What we're going to do then is that the Soviet Union did learn some lessons.
Yes, they did. And we'll have to pick it up there next week. Luciana, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Bye-bye, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.